Hello, and welcome to the Game Maker's Notebook. I'm Robin Hunneke, your host for these indie interviews at DICE 2019 here in Las Vegas. Today, we have Lucas Pope, whose game, Obra Dinn, is nominated for an award tonight. By the time you hear this podcast, you'll know if he won. But I want to say that like all the nominees, he is an amazing winner. In this podcast, what we're going to talk about is story, the development of narrative, and in particular, Lucas's personal narrative, how he became a developer, what he chose to focus on over the course of his development career, and how he reached the place that he is today. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to the Game Maker's Notebook, a podcast featuring a series of in-depth one-on-one conversations between game makers providing a thoughtful, intimate perspective on the business and craft of interactive entertainment. The Game Maker's Notebook is presented by the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences, a member-driven organization dedicated to the recognition and advancement of interactive entertainment.
Lucas today, talking about games.
Okay, hello everybody.
Talking about video games, but maybe we could start off talking a little bit about Las Vegas.
Okay, you're gonna do that to me, huh?
No. One of the things that that is always true is that you come to Vegas and people are like, "So, how do you like Vegas?" And I think almost every designer that I talk to is both infatuated by and repelled by Las Vegas because it's designed, but it's designed so explicitly for specific outcomes that it can feel both gorgeous and disgusting at the same
time.
That's
a good point. Yeah, it is. You do see the design on the surface in a lot of places, which is something that I find interesting.
Yeah.
But that only goes so far, I guess, as far as enjoying the environment.
Yeah. So being here, one of the things that I always think about is the stories that are happening all around you when you're walking around in Vegas. You're walking through a casino, there are people gambling, there are people that are dressed up for dinner, there are people that are here on vacation. It's the New Year, Chinese New Year, Year of the Pig, so there's stuff everywhere celebrating this idea of time has passed and your luck has changed. And I think a lot about how do people get here and why are they here and like what are they hoping to achieve? And I was thinking in getting ready for interviewing you about, you know, the fact that this is something that you seem drawn to as a developer, this idea of what happened, how is it happening, why did it happen, how is it going to unfold?
Yeah. That is actually a pretty interesting part of coming to Vegas, too, is just there's so many different kinds of people here. And you can do a lot of people watching, I guess. So you can just think about what brings these people here, what brings those people here.
Do you find yourself, do you think of yourself as a people watcher, someone who's inspired by the people around you, or are you more of a dreamer where you're in your mind?
I don't know. I mean, I think when I think about games and when I think about stories for games, they always, for some reason, have a lot of people in them. So I don't know if that's because I'm some kind of people watcher, but I think regular people just like interacting and lots of people are interesting to me. And I think it's the case that everybody, no matter how boring they may seem, has an interesting story to tell. So, you know.
What is your story? Like, if you were to just introduce yourself, let's do the thing where instead of having to cut in an introduction, you introduce yourself. Like, tell us who you are. Like, how did you get here? Like, let's hear a little story about how you ended
up in
Vegas.
That kind of podcast. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I think a lot of my story is just based on luck. I mean, what I would say is I make video games now, and I try to make games that I would like. So I kind of make games for myself, and I consider that to be a very fortunate position to be in. And I only got there by always kind of doing what I wanted to do. My parents always supported whatever crazy kind of creative thing I was working on. And I went to college for one thing, but ended up deciding I wanted to do software games, basically, instead.
What were you studying before you became a
mechanical engineering?
Okay.
So I was it was still engineering stuff, but it was more physical things that you would build and construct. And during my time there, I decided to take a C++ course, and I realized when Quake came out and all the things you could do with Quake that what I really wanted to be doing was making games. And then if I work just in software, I can skip all the kind of messy complications of the physical world.
You know, I have the same background.
Really?
Literally, yeah. Like, my background is in robotics and AI, and I was working on robots and Magellan-based robots and then the Sony Aibo and doing, like, sonar vision stuff and wayfinding. And then someone started simulating the same behavior stacks that I was working on in the robots in Half-Life Agents, in Half-Life Simulator, and I started thinking, you know, that's way easier.
It's like, way easier, and you can
screw
do anything.
All these, like, yeah. Motors and, like, the electricity is such a pain. The batteries were huge.
Yeah, I mean, that was exactly it.
Everything was always
just dealing with sensors and, and lubrication and things
it's
like
so
that.
It's so bad.
Like, yeah. So for me, I was a big fan of magic when I was a kid, just magic tricks and things. So when I could see what was possible in software, compared to what it was a kind of nice contrast between what you're doing mechanically and then what you can do in software. So for me, that was kind of what led me to games. And then I left college to start a game company, and that's not something that, you know, most parents would support, but my parents did support that. So that was another lucky break, and things didn't work out perfectly then. And that was back in 99 or something, late 90s.
Yeah.
So I've been making games for a really long time before I had Papers, Please, which is a game that I made on my own, but made enough money for me to support myself. So it took a long time, but, you know, I'm really happy with how things worked out.
What was the motivation for you to start? Because that's, you know, Justin Ma was just here, and we were talking about something very similar, this idea of being fortunate. But you weren't so fortunate at the very beginning. You had to really make the switch between doing what you thought you were going to do and following your bliss, which is not something a lot of people do, and then starting a game studio. Like, that in and of itself is a huge commitment, right? Like, you're committing to having employees and all these things, right?
I didn't know that at the time, but it wasn't
so
an informed decision.
Made in
exactly
ignorance.
I don't know. Our first computer was a Macintosh Plus, and for anybody who's not used that was the first computer. The Macintosh, black and white Macintosh, was the first computer with a proper user interface and a mouse and things like that. And that blew my mind when I was a kid. I had done, like, type in basic shit before that, but to see the Mac, and the Mac came with this this demo application to teach you how to use the mouse. And it was this kind of thing where you would, like, click on windows and birds would fly out, sort of thing. And it was just absolutely captivating for me. And then this other critical thing is that the Mac shipped, or at least the version we had this program called HyperCard.
Yeah.
Which was basically a really simple programming stack where you could program sprites to move around, or just really simple programming language, but simple but advanced. So it had object-oriented stuff. You could make sprites jump and move and things like that. And that was just kind of like flipped the switch in me that whereas previously I just played lots of, like, Atari 2600 or Nintendo games, now I could make these things move on screen by myself.
You know, that's my first programming language was
shut
programming.
Up. This
no,
is crazy.
This is, we're like the same person. This is, it's actually wigging me out. So I actually went to a summer camp when I was maybe 8 or 9, and there was a Mac there, and I used it to draw. And then the next time I saw it, I started poking around in HyperCard. And then fast forward to when I went to college in, like, 1991, there was a Mac there, and HyperCard was still on it. And I opened it up, and I started fiddling around with it. And it was the reason I decided to take my first computer programming class, which was called Computer Programming as a Liberal Art.
Wow.
And in it, you built simulations, A-life systems, population simulation, sort of like animal population simulators. And we used HyperCard and then SuperCard to do it. And I don't think I would be a programmer if it wasn't for HyperCard and SuperCard.
Yeah.
They made it so visual.
Right. It was so advanced. And, like, everything on the Mac, it was so different than what you would find on other systems.
Exactly.
They really, like, they made the focus very visual, and also just the sort of organizational structure of it based on these cards. You could program a card which could do anything, and then you could flip to another card any other time. So just the way that it was structured already was set up for you making small things or big things or whatever you wanted. Yeah, it was really brilliant.
And, you know, it's funny because until you just said that out loud, I didn't realize that my next game is totally influenced by that by that exact paradigm.
Yeah.
Yeah. My next game is cards all the way down and all the way up. Yeah. And like, I never thought about it until just now, but like, this is a visual programming thing that a lot of people don't get exposed to programming in this way.
Yeah.
Do you feel that it shaped the way that you build now?
For sure. Yeah. When I was a kid, I did this, I consider myself not an artist, but I was trying to be an artist. So mm-hmm. I drew a lot of stuff. And that's a case where you said you were drawing on the Mac. Mac Paint was amazing.
It was.
And I think it also was, you didn't have to be very good to make something look cool in Mac Paint, which was a good bonus for me. And then you go to HyperCard, you slip over to HyperCard, and you start drawing a sprite, and then you attach some behavior to it. So that the way you're thinking about it is not sort of from the programming side, but more about the how is it going to look in the end, or how is it going to be presented in the end to the player. And yeah, but for sure, that's something that has stuck with me.
You know, it's interesting to think about it from the perspective of if you can attach interactivity to art, then the art itself becomes something that is more than what you put into it. And I spent a lot of time in college and then grad school thinking about how do you make interactive things on the computer that seem alive, or that tell a story, or that give you a sense of the passage of time. So like my thesis, my undergraduate thesis is a HyperCard, SuperCard stack. It's an autobiographical narrative about my experience of my gender changing over time, where you can read different pieces of my history, and then as you read through them, they change as I age.
Yeah,
it's terrible, I'm sure now. If I went back and read it, I wrote it when I was 19. But I was so motivated to explore that notion of something changing over a period of time that was personal to me and communicating how those things changed. So maybe one of the reasons we're both really interested in this space is because of this very early seed. So when you decided to start making games for real, did you just go off and start making story-based games? Like the studio that you built, what was it like?
No, definitely not. Pretty much my entire trajectory has always been trying to make something different. I think I recognized my limitations in all these different areas that I was trying to work on. And instead of having the mind of, well, let's get a lot of people together and let's like work this out as like a team, not a team thing, but as like a big team thing. Instead, why don't we just pick something that's not as hard for us to do, but looks that not everyone else is doing. And that's kind of like a sort of engineering solution to the problem of how do you compete with other teams that have a lot more resources.
Yeah.
So from the beginning, I've always thought about making things that are different. And that just, once you do that for a couple years, decades maybe even, then you kind of stuck in that rut. Not a rut, but you're stuck in that mode where you're always thinking, you're always presenting yourself with challenges that can be solved by ways that other people don't solve them, basically.
Yeah. Actually, I think making things differently was one of the reasons that I wanted to start game jamming, like when that whole crew was like, let's make some games and put them up on the internet for free. I was like, well, that sounds cool because it's just not what video games are. Video games, when I started making games, they were a disc that you bought in a store, right? You had to know people to, in some cases, you had to travel to a store where you could buy video games. It was like a privilege to live in a city where there was a store that sold video games. And the idea of them being like massively available was, it was just a fiction, and you're in, you know, in the far future. But building strange prototypes and experiments and stuff was what I loved about being a graduate student in computer science. I loved being able to basically to play with a computer. It's not the kind of thing that was encouraged in my school. Most people didn't have computers. They were considered very expensive, and you couldn't play with a computer the way that you can now. And yet now, I feel like it's much more rare for people to just play with the computer than maybe it should be.
Yeah, that's another good point. Computers have, back in the 90s, I guess, there were things you did with a computer, but there was also this kind of open field of what else can you do with a computer? Like, what is a computer really good for? And you could try lots of different things. Now, people know what computers are for. It's for surfing the internet, basically, and playing games or running, you know, Excel. So there's less experimentation to just figure out how to use this machine that your parents like spent, you know, $6,000 on for your college courses and things like that. So, yeah. It was, and I mean, when I got my first my computer for college, it was like that, where it was like a 486, 16 meg. They used to have, just to take you back, they used to have these really thick catalogs called Computer Shopper magazine, which you would like buy your computer from. And it was, you would flip through and pick which computer you wanted. And then you would tell your parent, I told my parents, this is the one that would be good for me. And it was some old 486, like 66 megahertz, 16 megabyte, maybe not even 16 meg. But once you got it, I mean, you're supposed to be working on it, but you're in college. I was in college. It was in a dorm. Everyone installs Doom first thing. And you have this machine that is you need for your coursework, but also you're just spending time trying to figure out what kind of cool stuff you can do with it, basically. And there was a lot of experimentation with that sort of thing, too.
Well, and so when did you start to really feel like, okay, this is the medium for me to express myself? Like, in starting the game company, were you like, I'm going to be an artist and make games that express, or did that happen over time? Or
yeah, that was kind of over time. It was basically, I made a Quake mod with some friends on the internet in college, and then we decided, okay, let's take it to the next level. We'll find an engine, 3D engine out there that we can work with and make a full-on game, and we'll sell it to a publisher and we'll get a development contract or whatever. And we tried that. It was a pretty traditional third-person action-adventure sci-fi kind of game, and we couldn't sell it.
What was it called?
It's called Hab 12.
Hab 12.
Yeah. It was like this spaceship that had these habitats with alien creatures on them, and one of them breaks containment, obviously, and you have to go on and sort of fix things. It was pretty nice. I mean, it wasn't great, but also looked nice. We had a solid engine, some great art in it. But we couldn't sell it, and my solution was either break up the company or just make something that we could make ourselves that somebody else wasn't making. So there were lots of people are making third-person action-adventure games, so that's kind of our first problem. So let's make something that people are not making, but also that there's a market for. So this was the time when Deer Hunter games were really popular.
Yeah.
Basically, at that time, Walmart was the number one PC game distributor in America. So we went to Walmart and we looked at what was there. And one of the things that was not there that I knew was popular were car mechanic games. I had fixed cars with my dad when I was a kid. And I knew from where I lived in Virginia that a lot of people like fixing cars. So we decided, let's make a game about fixing cars. And before then, there had been racing games where you repair your car or you upgrade your car, but I was adamant that this is a game only about fixing cars.
Just fixing cars.
Yeah, you can't race your car. You can't get in your car, nothing. You fix it and you stick it in the lot. And I knew that this was compelling because that's what me and my dad did.
Yeah.
We fixed up MGs and just sat there. He would drive them a little bit and then he would, you know, sell it or something. Like that.
Yeah.
And so we did that next, and that we did end up selling that. That one sold pretty well, actually. It's a game called Gearhead Garage. Once that happened, that's when I realized, okay, this is the kind of game I want to make, and A, and B, I can handle that, basically. I can come up with more ideas, kind of weird ideas like that.
Yeah. So. And so then you were just like, all right, I'm going to make this kind of game for a while.
Yeah. That immediately after failed, that didn't work out for much longer. And so we ended up closing the studio and I moved to LA and got a job in Serious Games after that, kind of.
And so what drove you to try to do, did you do your practice while you were working, or did you get a job in Serious Games to understand that space? And then did that infect your practice? Like, how did that end up?
No,
what was that handshake?
Okay, one tricky thing about the game industry is in order to get a job, you have to work in the game industry. So you need experience before you can get a job.
It's true.
So working in your own game company doesn't count, actually. So I kind of looked around for a long time for a place to go and ended up... Serious Games is a little bit more flexible with who they hire because the work is a little different. So I was able to get a job at this company called Real Time. And they were working on a really nice project based on research about kids and chemo. So,
cool.
I got the job there, and it wasn't really I was trying to learn anything. It was just that's where I could get a job, and also I could, you know, survive. I could make money there. I wasn't making any money at our studio anymore. So, I learned a lot there. But that was a pretty traditional, as far as games go, the construction of that game was pretty traditional. So I wouldn't say I learned a lot of experimental stuff there.
And when did you start feeling the urge to write Papers, Please and basically start designing that?
Well, that wasn't for much later. So I worked there for a while. Then I moved to Naughty Dog, where I worked on Uncharted games. And then from, I learned so much at Naughty Dog, but always kind of had in the back of my mind that I want to be working on smaller experimental games. So it's when I left Naughty Dog, my wife is also a game developer. So we decided, let's try to make independent games together for a while. And we did for a while, and things were okay. Not great, not terrible. We were able to at least survive on our savings for a couple years. And then I had basically one last idea that I wanted to do before I went and got a job, because my wife was pregnant at the time. So that's kind of the last moment you have to get your shit together, basically. And that idea was Papers, Please. And it was, I worked in, when I left Naughty Dog, I went to Singapore, actually, and worked for a year with a friend. We both worked on this PlayStation game. And we lived in Singapore for a year and traveled a lot around Southeast Asia, basically. And so I had gone through a lot of immigration checkpoints and airports and things for the U.S. and for, you know, Indonesia and Thailand and Singapore and Japan. And I just, at some point, kind of recognized the game side of what the inspectors were doing by just checking documents. And I thought, well, just correlating information on documents looks like it could be like a fun thing. You could gamify that. And that's what led to Papers, Please. And it exploded way beyond my expectations. Once I had the mechanics down, I didn't have an idea for a story, but once I had the mechanics, I sort of saw the potential of a story and tried to weave that back into the mechanics and work out something that would be different and new. And so the idea was I would finish Papers, Please, and then release it. It would sell a little bit, and then I would go and get a job back. Maybe we would move back to the States, or I would find a job in Tokyo or something like that. But things worked out that it sold well enough that I didn't need to find any other job.
And when you were initially experiencing this like change from working at a serious games company to Naughty Dog, and then from Naughty Dog to working on these prototypes on your own, did you understand that you were collecting experiences that would inform your practice, or was it more like it just happened and then later you look back and go, that was a good time, you know?
I would definitely say if I had to give anything credit for sort of my system, my processes now, it's Naughty Dog.
Yeah.
So before I started at Naughty Dog, I was mostly an engineer concerned about the quality of the things I was making. So how good the source code looks or how well the systems are designed, that sort of thing, how fail-proof, like fault-proof they were. When I started working at Naughty Dog, everybody there is really, really good. But they're not good just in the way of they make great systems and great code, but they know, they're very focused about what matters when you're making a game. So they won't get lost in making the perfect code if it doesn't matter to the final result. And so finding that what you're focusing on and then sort of efficiently directing your energy was something that I learned at Naughty Dog. And the general style of production there, on Uncharted 1, Uncharted 2 was very much like that, like finding the focus of your game and then cutting away everything else that doesn't add to that, or being willing to cut everything away that doesn't add to that. And also not focusing on your one small contribution to the game, but kind of the holistic, how it applies to everything. So that kind of let me cut loose or cut away the very OCD focused engineer side and realize like what was really important in the game was all those other things, the kind of the bigger picture. And that has been absolutely critical in making games on my own, basically, to find a focus and to solve the problem, the resource problem, instead of the game, how is this game going to look, or how is it going to look underneath, or what systems am I going to build to make this game?
This kind of perfectionism is something that Justin and I were talking about earlier. I think it's a really interesting surface. I also went to AAA games and then ended up going indie. And by the time I left EA and went to work on Journey, I think I had learned a very similar thing, which is that there are reasons to do things, and then there are reasons. Yeah. It's like you can be having a production conversation about a feature set, and the lead engineer will say, well, but if we do it this way, no, will happen. And you can say, well, yes, but if we do it the other way, we'll lose another 6 weeks. And it doesn't really matter to me if it can't do these three edge cases that you're talking about.
Yeah.
What matters to me is that it's in the bill that's going for review next month.
Yeah.
And so you need to get it done now. It's more important that it influences these three systems in this way than it is that it's perfect.
Yeah.
If we really need it to be perfect later, we can always go back and fix those.
Yeah, that
cases.
Was exactly the kind of the setup there too, is that you get it in as quickly as possible. And then they had this really unique system that I've never heard of anywhere else where the build was live all the time. So when an artist makes a level or a piece of level and checks it in, it's live for everybody in the studio. They don't work on their own copies of things and then check them in when they're perfect. So when things break, everybody knows right away. And that kind of sets up this motivation to get stuff in as quickly as possible. Even if it's not perfect, you get it in and then people can put the control in their hand and start messing with it right away. So yeah, that's not exactly how I work, but that sort of cycle of what's important here is how it's going to play in your hand, basically, not what you've done to get it there.
It's a very difficult thing to teach. And so do you work by yourself now mostly?
I work by myself exclusively.
Okay. Yeah. And so I teach, and I also, you know, Phenomena has like 30 people, and a lot of the people that I teach and interact with and also work with at Phenomena are young. And one of the hardest things to tell a young person who's making games is that it doesn't matter if it's perfect. It matters if it feels good.
Yeah.
This is like, please help me.
Yeah, I have no idea.
By describing this in detail.
One of the reasons I work alone is because I can't describe this. I can't manage people and I can't. Yeah. And I don't teach for that same reason.
The whole purpose of
this. Well, I mean, for me, I think one very important way to teach that is just to make them finish a game.
Yeah.
Like finishing games is absolutely critical to learning what to focus on. Until you finish a game and look back on it, you have no idea what was important or not. And one of the things that comes up all the time for me is when I'm starting on the game, I think this one thing is super important, like critical. It's going to define the game.
Yep.
When the game finally comes, when I finish it, I realize that was like the least important thing. It had no effect on the actual quality of the game. And it's impossible to teach that or to learn that until you actually go through it and you finish the game and you look back on it. And one of the cool things about Naughty Dog is when I was working there, we finished Uncharted 1 8 months after I started. So that like, there wasn't a long time where I had doubts about whether things were going to work or not. It was moving so fast, and the game came out and was awesome, that it gave me like enough time to remember all the shit that I was worried about didn't matter at all, basically.
Yeah, this feedback loop is the same thing that allows a game that's systems-based in the ways that yours are to feel interesting over time, right?
Yeah.
It's that same feedback loop of try something and then immediately get feedback.
Yeah.
Try something and see what it does to the narrative. Try something and regret it,
right?
So when you start to think about something new, like let's talk about the transition between Papers, Please and Overden. Like how did you handle that gap? There's always this gap between like you finish a thing, it blows up, gets to the place where you're starting to need to do the next thing, and there's an energy that builds, or there's like a motivation.
Yeah.
What was that like for you?
Well, for Overden, I had been thinking about making a 1-bit rendering game, 3D game, for a while. While I was working on the localization for Papers, Please. So I released Papers, Please in English only, and I spent about 4 months on the localizations for it. It was a tough game to localize. But during that time, I was thinking I want to try my hand at 3D, because I wanted to get back into the 3D pipeline, because I believe in the potential of VR, basically. Mm-hmm. So I wanted, let me get ready for 3D, get ready for VR by doing a 3D project. But I don't want it to be impossible, and I also don't want to compete with most other 3D studios, so 1-bit would be perfect, basically. And jumping into it was pretty easy. Once I had finished Papers, Please localization, jumping into it was pretty easy because I was switching engines, so there's a lot of new stuff to learn.
Okay.
I was switching tool sets. I had to learn Maya. There was like so much stuff to learn that I couldn't really, I couldn't slow down, basically. And it was one of the things I love about making games, and one of the main reasons I make games is because I'm constantly learning new things.
Yeah.
So that was just a lot of fun the first year or two of just like learning how to make this game.
You know, this is something that I've had to explain to people repeatedly when they ask me why Phenomena works on VR and AR titles when the market is so small, and you know, why not just keep making PlayStation games forever, you know? Why not just keep making a walking simulator forever, yeah. Like Journey 2, 3, 4, you know? And the answer is totally that you learn by having to use new hardware, you learn by having to solve design problems in new spaces. Like the design problems you have to solve in VR and AR are huge. Yeah. You're really redesigning, especially in AR, you're redesigning the way that people experience time, space, and physics. Like you can completely ignore so many of the things that normally constrain your physical reality. Yeah. And it's all around you. What an exciting prospect. It's also terrifying because if you're not careful, you can recreate, hey, computers are for browsing the internet and playing video games, and this new tool can become just so limited, right? Yeah. But that learning process is, I think this is something that a lot of designers have, the urge to continue to learn, whether it's new subjects, new tools, or both, right?
Yeah. Yeah. For me, I will almost like try to create problems that I don't have any idea how to solve them, just so I can learn about the fields or the academics or whatever that are required to solve them.
Yeah. So, yeah. Are you a book collector? Do you like to read?
Are you an internet reader? I'm not going to go that far. I read a lot of stuff researching Oberdin, but yeah, I'm an internet reader kind of guy.
And what did you research? What was the thing that fascinated you the most in that process?
So there were a lot of good books about sailing ships, trade ships. And literature was different back then, I'm talking like 1700s, 1800s.
Yeah.
So it was even interesting just to see how different a book would be written back then. But mostly a lot of the research was about how the ship would be constructed and how the people would be using the ship or sailing the ship. And that is a very deep subject.
It is.
Yeah. What I realized is that model shipbuilders have been studying this for hundreds of years, basically, and they've been writing their stuff down, but it's only in physical books. It's nothing online.
No.
I had to order a lot of old, you know, out of print books, used books from the UK and things like that to study this stuff. It's just really interesting. It was most of it over my head, but I had to pick out the parts of it that I felt would work in the game or that could inform the narrative and things like that.
I recently was in Santa Fe, out in Arizona, actually. And I stayed in a hotel, and there was a copy of a book there that I ended up buying when I left called The Black Joke. And it's about a sailing ship in Newfoundland and a family that's trying to use the ship to fish for a living and some drama that happens. It's kind of like a Hardy Boys narrative.
Okay,
Hardy Boys. Yeah, that's right. Hardy Boys narrative about these two brothers who are trying to survive when their dad gets kidnapped and this kind of stuff happens. But it was filled with these beautiful etchings, print block etchings. They're just gorgeous, of the ship. And a lot of the language in the book was about the ship itself, the love that they had for the ship, the way that the family depended upon it. It was like the equivalent of their computer, you know?
Yeah.
It was the equivalent of like something that it was such a tool for them, but it was also like a persona in a way. And I really fell in love with the book, and it turned out it was written by a guy who was studying the cultures of Newfoundland and like what's it like in basically fishing communities that were basically going to go away.
Yeah.
And it was so romantic to me. It was written in the 60s. To think about the smells and the sounds and the ways in which these kids were surviving, literally on the crest of the ocean, you know?
Yeah, this is interesting because that was what those sailing ships were back in the 1700s, 1800s, is they were this sense of it, this adventure, this promise of adventure.
Yeah.
And one of the strong themes in a lot of this literature is that the son would feel constricted or restricted at home and say, I'm going to go sail. I'm going to go find my life adventure on the high seas. And then get there and realize it was just an absolute nightmare, just a hellscape of death and cold weather.
Disease.
Yeah. And just the worst thing that he ever could have done. And he regretted it from the moment that he was, you know, thrown on in the quarter, like wherever, just on. The, yeah. And that to me was really interesting too, because yeah, exactly like you say, it sounds so romantic and it sounds so nice. And one of the books I read was about true disasters on sailing ships. And they were all true accounts written by survivors. And you learn pretty quick that life was very cheap back then.
Yeah.
People died in the hundreds on these boats when they go down. And the people who survived were the biggest assholes who basically survived at the expense of somebody else. And they weren't vilified at all. They were heroes because everyone understood how fragile their life was out there. And if you made it back, no matter what the circumstances were, we want to read all about your account, basically.
You know, it's so interesting. So when Phenomena turned 5 years old, I thought about it and I went to Seattle for PAX and I got two tattoos. I got two giant diving swallows, one on each arm. And one is green and one is blue. And they're huge. And I got them after reading about how sailors would get these swallows tattooed on their chest on one side when you left and one side when you came back. Yeah. And the fiction was that if you died while you were out there, the birds would carry you up to heaven. But if you came back and you had two, that meant you were a total badass. And I think that my dad was a sailor. My dad sailed in the Merchant Marine. And I grew up looking at a tin of coins that he had collected from all the sailing he'd done all over the world. And I can remember as a kid opening this metal Planter's peanut tin and spreading the coins out on the bed, my parents' bed, and looking at all these different languages and colors of currency. Sometimes they'd be casino chips. Sometimes they would be, just little tiny coins with holes in them. Like, that's almost not even a coin. Like, what is that? Sometimes they'd be these big hulking things. And just thinking, like, someday I'm going to travel the world and see all these kinds of places. I'm going to be a sailor. And then, unfortunately, when I was about 12, my grandpa was like, let's go on a deep sea fishing trip. We were living in Florida at the time and rented a boat. My brother and I went out. I ate a Snickers bar at 9 a.m. and then I threw up for like 6 hours.
Kill that dream, huh?
Yeah. I love boats and I love sailing. And I do have this idea of the romantic quality, but the hellscape quality is also extremely, extremely true for me. I love to scuba dive. If I'm going to go on a dive, I have to start taking Dramamine days in advance. I have to like really, really zen out about it because I'll get seasick on the water in the gear, just going
so
up
you
and down.
So you can scuba dive even with that?
I can do it because I love it that much.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, there's a reason that there's this sort of
diving. Yeah, I have really
sequence.
Bad motion sickness too. And that's basically my nix on scuba diving at all.
It's the thing is if you can go to a place with calm seas, you can do it, especially if you do it in warmer water, it's less stressful.
Yeah.
But I learned to scuba dive while we were working on Journey, and that's why there's this kind of diving kelpy sequence in it, because Matt and I both loved diving in the kelp forests off the coast. It's freezing, but it's so gorgeous, you know? So when you were thinking about these, like, the lives of these sailors and this hellscape, literally the contrast between the romance and the disaster, how much of that were you compelled to sort of, like, to follow in the process, and like, how did that work for you?
Well, it offers just a lot of potential, I guess. I tried to show kind of how people work together on a ship, the sort of stuff they need to deal with. Oberdin's a little fantastic, so it's not exactly what they would be going through. But when I read those stories, I realized the kind of potential for how interesting just human interactions could be. People making decisions about what to do, or screwing over their crewmates to save themselves, or not screwing them, like sacrificing themselves to save someone else. And so that all just kind of suggested to me a lot of interesting story beats or story elements.
And then when did you start to know, well, like, how long did it take to make it?
It took 4.5 years. So a long time.
And did you expect it to take that long?
No, I thought I'd be done in 3 to 6 months.
Okay. So this is like the conversation that all indies have, right?
Yeah.
You start off with the idea. You think, this is doable. I can manage this. And then 4 years later, you look back and you think, wow. As Justin said in the last podcast, I just got a degree in this story. I literally got a 4-year degree in in my game, right? So this is like, what was that like?
I don't know if Justin had this problem, but I added a couple years there just because I was trying to follow Papers, Please, more or less.
Oh, like, interesting.
Papers, Please was a big hit, and people were wondering what I was going to do next. And that put on enough pressure for me to not take my time, but to just take longer, to be more worried about everything, to stress out, to try different stuff, more different things. But really, what really killed me on this project was all the work. It was really just the straight-up amount of work of like modeling all the characters, modeling the ship, doing all the sound effects, all the music, writing all the code, doing all the audio. That design-wise, I had the components for what would make the game, and I stuck them together in different ways and finally came up with something that worked out okay. But just the level of production resources required for it. And I was using Maya, which is not kind at all to a small studio, and especially not to a single person. So I didn't have the ability to put up with things the way that most people do with Maya. So I would spend a lot of time engineering solutions to things. And I'm a tools guy at heart, so I built a lot of tools to help me make the game, and that takes time.
It does.
It's a different kind of game than most games because it's a... All these flashbacks are in the same location. So I modeled one ship, but I modeled it across 50 different flashbacks. And the way the ship articulates and the way that the characters change or change their clothes or get injured or whatever in different scenes, all that is pretty, I would say, non-standard for what games do. So a lot of my time was just spent figuring out how to take these tools that most people use, like Maya or Photoshop, and then make the game that I want to make using those things.
Yeah, this is the challenge of being someone who wants to tell a story with some kind of fidelity, even the one bit approach, right? In the end, we were talking about this a little bit today as well, and this idea of like there's this huge spectrum. So there's like the Naughty Dog or like Insomniac kind of size team that's like, okay, this is the target market. Here's the story. We're going to build this amazing game, and we're going to go for it. And then way down here, there's like Justin and Matt working together on the game, just two people or one person, like Jake working on Gorgoa for 7 or 8 years, painfully hand rotoscoping, thousands of scenes and then cutting them and putting them back together. And like in the middle are all these other ways of developing. And like where you are down at the far end of the extreme with this core group of people that like is so dedicated to making a single thing. Did you ever think about like hiring a bunch of people to do the modeling and like trying to build up a studio again? Like you've had the experience in the middle and you've chosen the far left.
Yeah, for me,
Why?
Well, it was way harder making it by myself, but I also benefited from a lot of efficiencies of being the only guy working on a game.
Like what?
Well, everything's in my head, so I don't need to explain to a sound guy or anybody else what's happening in the scene and how they should map it out. I can do everything a little bit. So I'm a pretty bad micromanager when it comes to that sort of thing. So for me, a lot of times it's easier just to do it myself. But also, my idea of the game is changing kind of frequently. So when you have to tell other people that things are changing or when you have to cut other people's work, that's really difficult for me. It's easier for me to just cut my own work or to change it in my head and start doing things differently by myself. But those efficiencies of having everything in my head... are pretty striking, especially for Oberdin, where I was making a different kind of game with a different kind of visual style and a different kind of pipeline. I had control over the beginning of the pipeline and the end of the pipeline and how it comes out at the other end. So when I'm, for instance, like making a texture in Photoshop, I know exactly what the shader is going to do to each of the RGB channels on that and exactly how I'm going to combine that with everything else and exactly how it's going to look on the screen of the player at the end. And that's pretty powerful stuff when you need to optimize what you're working on.
Yeah. So you have a, like an extensive knowledge of the systems in the game that aren't even built yet because they're in your head.
Right.
And you have an understanding of what it's supposed to look like and feel like because you're simulating it all the time. One of the hardest things I think about making games with other people is this feeling that like you didn't communicate it effectively, so out broken on the other side in a way that you couldn't possibly have imagined.
Yeah.
But there's also just the fact that those people are running a simulation that's different than yours,
and
sometimes the surfaces of those simulations do not match.
Yeah, so there are kind of two problems there. Is how do you solve that problem of like better communication or better management? And then the other problem is how do I make it so I can make this game by myself? And so of those two sets, I just decide, okay, how can I scale things back or how can I build a tool that will help me just finish it by myself.
Yeah, this is actually one of the challenges of running a business, you know, is that you can create an environment for this stuff to happen. But then if you need to be there as well to do all the design work day in and day out, there's no one to go out and raise money or to go out and promote the games or to go out. And so it ends up being that you have to build a crew of people that you can kind of decompartmentalize individual components of it and then find and raise designers and producers and artists and programmers and sound designers inside that can do that. And that's a really long process. You know, it's really complicated.
Yeah. I think that's the kind of thing I would probably be doing if Papers, Please didn't do so well. I mean, I'm very much a product of what I've done before. So because Papers, Please was successful and I didn't have a biz dev guy and I didn't have a team of programmers or a team of artists and, you know, I didn't do any big marketing PR push, it's hard for me to mess with a formula that's working. And so far, I mean, there's no reason for me to screw with it. And I feel lucky because I enjoyed working on Papers, Please. And even though Oberdin was a tough 4.5 years, I did enjoy working on it and learning all new things. So.
Well, and so what did you do in your process to maintain sanity when you got stuck? Like, do you have things that you do when you feel like claustrophobic about looking at the same game for 4 years, you know?
My usual thing was just to switch disciplines. So I would be working on programming and I'd get kind of tired of it. So I'd switch to graphics or music or something like that. But really, what made Oberdin possible is the fact that I have 2 kids and a wife and was able to rely on them to sort of show me that there's more to life than making games. And not just that, but my family cares about me, and they don't really care about my game. Not to say they don't, you know, like they're going to like the game because they like me.
Yeah.
So if the game sucks and it fails, they don't care at all. They're mostly worried about how I feel about it. Yeah. And so once I kind of realized that my family to me was more important than how the game turned out, it got a lot easier. So it took me a while to get to that point. And until that point, I was really worried about how to follow Papers, Please, and what do I do? And what if this is not perfect? And then I realized, you know, my kids are growing up while I'm worrying about this shit, and they don't care about it now. And they may look back on it and remember those times, but what they'll remember is, you know, that I wasn't there and I wasn't happy. So I decided, well, I actually enjoy spending time with them, and that sort of that gives me so much strength, I guess, to work on the game that I'll just keep kind of puttering along on this, keep doing the things I need to do. There was so much stuff I needed to do on Oberdin that wasn't, it was kind of rote. I wouldn't say rote, but it was kind of, it was like, this needs to get done. I need to make 50 of these scenes, need to model these characters.
It was
bordering on brainless. So I could work on those things without stressing out too much and then kind of just fall back on my family, you know, on spending time with them.
This is, I think it's a theme that I've been hearing a lot lately with independent developers and developers in general, but like I also have really, over the last couple of years especially, I think I've learned that like having people that love you in your life, who care about you and believe in you regardless of whether your game is successful or whether your company
perspective
is successful,
helps a lot. Yeah.
It really does. And I think that sense of unconditional love that comes from that kind of closeness, especially with kids or a partner, is it's indescribably critical, and it's another one of those things that you cannot tell young people. Like you cannot tell people.
I would say, yeah, it's one of those things where you should go for a while without it, because, you know, I'm pretty old and now it's the best thing that could ever happen to me. If I was younger and I needed to work, you know, 3 days in a row on a crunch, it would be a lot harder, honestly. Yeah. So, there was kind of a point when we had kids when I realized sort of the scope of life or whatever, you know, of like work and how you sort of balance that sort of thing. And you just, I think you reach an age where you realize like what's important is the people in your family who are close to you. Because before that, you know, you're driven about how are people going to remember me? How can I make a game that people really love? So it took me a while to get there, but I got there working on Oberdin. So
do you think it had an influence on the story itself, that process?
Maybe a little bit. Like I found that once I had kids, you know, the way I experience media is a little different. So now when in a blockbuster movie, when a kid gets kidnapped, it means a lot more to me than it used to.
Yeah.
I was kind of going that direction anyways before I had kids, but yeah, kids intensified it for me for sure. Having kids, in that sort of situation made it more, made me realize how relationships can affect stories or how important relationships can be when you're telling a story.
It's interesting too, because relationships shape the way we perceive ourselves. They shape the way that we perceive our work and our ability to work in a way that is, it's not often respected in capitalist cultures. You know, it's a really difficult thing to explain. I mean, this is something I talk about all the time. Like, people say, well, why not move Phenomena to the middle of nowhere where the rents are low and la, la, la. And what I say is there are lovely, beautiful, artistic, creative people living in San Francisco that deserve to earn a living wage to be in a city where they feel safe and respected and can be with their loved ones. And like, it doesn't make sense to make games like they're donuts, you know, just in order to be able to make more of them.
Yeah.
That maybe making fewer things and spending more time on the journey has an impact on the content.
Yeah, one of the things I really like about the last 5 or 10 years is that games are getting easier to make, you know, with things like Unity. So you have more people making games. And just that field has expanded so much now that you can make games and be happy, and you can make different kinds of games and be in a situation where you're not just worried about going to the office and working on a game. So, yeah.
This is such a valuable thing to understand and also to communicate, I think, right now, because there's a lot of talk about, you know, the mobile games market is collapsing, or it's like getting really hard to get over the fold on stores. You know, it's difficult for independent people to make a living. It's even difficult for, you know, for some corporate game companies to, like, you know, really big companies with deep pockets to make hits consistently. But I think it's kind of always been this way.
Yeah,
you know,
it's always been hard.
Yeah. And this is like the perspective that we have as a culture of developers now can be about sharing the fact that it isn't just like an idea comes fully formed into your head and then you just make a list and then you make it. It's the way that we market games is often like, hey, look, this new thing is available. This person thought of it. They're going to tell you all about it. Now buy it. And it doesn't really communicate the process, which in a way devalues the work.
Yeah, I guess that's kind of a downside of it being so easy to make games. There's a lot of games. But for me, that downside is much shallower than the upside of you just get more kinds of games from more kinds of people. And when I had the idea for Oberdin, it was a lot more complicated, but it was the core of the idea was instead of killing people all the time, which is what most games do, you would be dying all the time. And so it was more about the death than the killing. And that's a kind of bullshit indie idea that you can make games out of now that you couldn't before. You couldn't make games because there was no market for it. But now you've got online distribution. You can find people who will like your game if you can find some weird game. And to me, that's huge, basically. I mean, because the AAA stuff, the safe bets still work and people still make those games, but there's this potential there for people to make more personal games, more experimental games, and to actually make a living doing it.
So. Yeah, I think when you look at games like Gorgo or Florence, you know, all the games that are nominated in these awards that are made by smaller studios and independent studios, what you see is there's heart that you can see in games now in a way. It's like there's a genuine communication that comes from a few people collaborating to say something together that is just as compelling as a lot of people building an amazing carnival experience that takes you on a super journey. You know, like this is they're both really valuable, but it used to be that the primary experience was get on this amazing ride and ride through this amazing theme park, not, hey, can I tell you a story?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm a big believer in the power of interactive media to do lots of different things. And, you know, to see that games are mostly focused on shooting things and killing things is for me kind of a letdown based on what games or interactive media is possible. And VR is kind of the same way, where I feel like games are going to be great in VR, but VR to me is way bigger than games.
It is.
The fact, you know, the presence and the interactivity of VR is something that's way beyond games. It's coming from games now because we're the industry with the technology that can handle it. But it's the same thing where actually, like, now is kind of like a renaissance of maybe 30 years ago when video games and were first coming about, where people didn't know what a game was.
Yeah.
So they would try all kinds of different things, and then they kind of figured out what it was in the late 80s, and then they've been making the successful stuff for, you know, 20 years or whatever. And now we're getting back to the point where it's more experimental. You have more potential. You have these, because you have Unity, because you have an Unreal, you don't need everything else to make a game. You can make a game with your own idea. And so we're getting just a lot more great ideas. And I feel like that's pushing us beyond what games traditionally are,
yeah,
which is a good thing.
Actually, I would say that you can go even further than that and say with, like, you know, tools like PlayFab or Spatial OS, these things that people are developing that help us distribute content in the cloud as well, there's like a huge potential for massively multiplayer games,
yeah,
to have a huge innovation wave. I'm really excited actually by the potential of both AR, VR, and online play and connectedness, yeah, becoming mechanics that we play with the same way we've now started to play with 2D versus 3D and like shaders. And we're getting more and more comfortable with the vocabularies of connectedness,
yeah,
than we ever have been before. And I think that's really great, you know?
I do too.
It's an amazing time to be a game developer. And on that note, I think we're going to say goodbye. Do you have anything that you're going to be doing in the next little bit? Like, are you going to be giving a talk at GDC? Are you going to be anywhere where your fans can see you, that kind of stuff?
I'll be at GDC showing Oberdin. I got nominated for IGF, so I'll have a spot there showing the game. And that's pretty much it.
Okay, great. Yeah. It was really fantastic to chat with you today. Thanks for taking the time.
Had a great time. Thank
you. All right, thanks.
Thank you for joining us for the Game Maker's Notebook. For more information on the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences, our podcasts, and our other initiatives, please visit www.interactive.org.